President Trump contracting COVID-19 only compounds the potential hurdles of this year's election, especially if he dies. If he survives, which is likely, then his and Mike Pence's name will still be on the ballot and things will go as before. Obviously, as before meant with a lot of other potential hurdles and complications that can cause a potential constitutional crisis. But if Donald Trump were to die, then things would get really complicated. When a presidential candidate dies before the election, it is up to the party to come up with a replacement. But we have never had a presidential candidate, at least a viable one, die just weeks before an election. And at this point, it's hard to imagine states being able to reprint new ballots, as many people have actually already began to vote. So even if Donald Trump were to die due to complications of COVID-19, his name would still likely be on the ballot. If he lost that election, and if Biden won and he's in good health, then there's no issue there. Biden wins, other than the things that we've been talking about on the show about other possible complications. Don't know if they would push a potential constitutional crisis if the candidate they want had actually deceased, but who knows? But if Trump were to win, well, then we would actually be in uncharted territory if he wasn't actually alive. The decision would come probably down to the electors, but that's controversial in of itself, the electors in the Electoral College. And then their decision could be objected to by Congress when it meets to certify the election. Then you could have a potential situation where Congress decides who the next president will be. Well, that's happened twice before in history, in the elections of 1800 and 1824, both very contentious elections in of themselves. This is a scenario that could, meaning the controversies and the hurdles that need to be passed in a potential constitutional crisis that could happen even if Donald Trump has a full recovery from COVID-19, due just to the controversy surrounding mail-in ballots and other things. Possible. I'm not saying likely, but possible. And when these uncertain times arise in election, well, we have a history showing that almost anything can happen. And today we're going to go back to history to talk about another election that was also unusually resolved and the compromise over it that would bring to an end the United States government's post-Civil War era attempt to enfranchise African Americans. And that's the election of 1876. For that conversation, I'm very happy to be joined via Skype by Richard Kreitner. Richard Kreitner is a contributing writer to The Nation. He has a number of op-eds, including the Washington Post, about the lessons from the election of 1876. And he is also the author of the book, Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. Richard Kreitner joins us from New York City. Richard Kreitner, welcome to this radio program. Let's begin by talking about what's important to know about the time frame of this election, 1876. This is just 11 years after the end of the Civil War.
That's right. That's exactly the important context, is that the country had just 10 years earlier, 11 years earlier, gotten out of this massive nation-wrenching crisis that had been, you know, provoked by a disputed presidential election, not where the actual results were disputed, but where one side basically refused to accept victory. So the nation's already gone through this incredibly violent struggle where 750,000 or so Americans died, the equivalent today of 8 million Americans dying, over whether the country would stay together, over whether what it meant to submit to democratic principles and to a democratic election and what legitimacy meant. And people were very worried that the election of 1876 was going to catapult them into a similar crisis again. The other important context is that 1876 was the centennial years, the 100th anniversary of American independence from Britain. And everybody hoped that this would be a moment of moving beyond the Civil War and beyond that kind of division within the country. And it'd be kind of a celebratory moment. But instead, by the end of the year, this election is up in the air. Nobody knows how it's going to land. And the country's right back on the brink of violence and of crisis. And what was at stake in this moment is basically the fate of Reconstruction, which is the program pushed by the Republican Party after the Civil War to rebuild the South, to rebuild the Southern states that had seceded, that had supported slavery and then seceded for the sake of perpetuating it, and to make, you know, to dedicate them to racial equality and to liberty, you know, to essentially the founding principles. And this was fought, you know, basically every step of the way by most Southern whites, not all of them. Some of them supported these Reconstruction government-empowered Black political leaders and Black voters. But most Southern whites were kind of unredeemed and wanted, you know, if not to secede from the Union again, to restore the Union to its antebellum status of supporting white supremacy, basically, and refusing to recognize Black civil rights. So one by one, they target these Southern states for overthrow, you know, often violent ones. They assassinate Black politicians. They terrorize the Black population generally, and they're basically trying to eviscerate support for Reconstruction. And eventually, you know, this is the Republican Party is they lose Congress in 1874. They lose the House of Representatives, and they're deciding whether their commitment to Reconstruction, to Black equality, is a disadvantage in elections. So they're deciding whether to stay committed to it, and Democrats are kind of roaring back towards political prominence, making the argument that to restore the Union as it was. That was their slogan, which is the Union as it was before the Civil War, you know, basically devoted to white people and their interests solely. So this is kind of the background question that is at stake in the 1876 election. And it is part of what makes the stakes so high and why both sides are willing, or at least say they are, to go to war for the sake of winning it.
That's interesting, because the midterm election before the presidential election of 1876, the Democrats finally get a majority in Congress. What was it, both houses of Congress that they got a majority, or?
I don't know about the Senate. I'm pretty sure it was only the lower, it was only the House of Representatives.
House of Representatives, yeah. And so they finally are back into power in the House of Representatives. Then 1876 comes. Talk to me more about this concern about re-entering or having even a second Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, that comes kind of later on in the crisis. The election pits the Republican candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, who fought for the Union, versus Samuel Tilden, who's a Democratic lawyer from New York, extremely wealthy as the Democratic Party candidate. And the election is very, very close. And it comes down to the fact that there's contested results in four states, in Oregon, in Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina. And it's the last three that are kind of important for the story. And basically, the reason that those votes are contested is because there are these white gangs siding with the Democrats who are going around intimidating voters, Republican voters, and especially Black voters, to keep them away from the polls. And of course, you know, to going to today, Trump has openly suggested that his supporters should monitor polling booths to avoid voter fraud, so-called. So that's kind of an extremely frightening parallel with this episode. And because of that, Republican governments in those three Southern states, I think all three, refused to certify the ballots, or they're contested. The legislatures and the governors send different slates of electors to Congress for certification. So nobody knows which way these states actually voted or which votes should be counted. And what that does is it deprives anybody of a majority in the Electoral College. And so you're at a stalemate now. The election is thrown into the House of Representatives, which also, for various reasons, is not able to come to a determination as to who won. And the Senate is similarly gridlocked. So nobody knows who the president is going to be. And they're weeks from the inauguration day, which was then March 4th. And what Congress does is so this is the point at which both sides begin talking about using violence in order to inaugurate their candidate. Democrats, including George McClellan, who was, you know, famously the Union general fired by Lincoln, he's in touch with a lot of comrades from the war who support the Democrats, and they're encouraging him to start basically building an army in case it's necessary to install Tilden as president. And some Republicans who also are Union veterans are talking about the same thing. Ulysses S. Grant, who's the president, of course, you know, was the victorious general in the Union. He's getting concerned that his legacy of ending one civil war will be tarnished by his failure to avoid another. So what he does is he staffs Washington, D.C. area forts that had been basically, you know, abandoned ever since Appomattox because nobody thought that they would be needed again. And he starts sending troops to them once again in case Washington needs to be defended or an insurrection needs to be suppressed. So people are talking really quite seriously about civil war. Tilden, who probably could have caused a lot of, you know, harm and violence had he raised a finger in support of the efforts that McClellan and others were starting to organize, kind of avoids the issue, and it kind of holes up in his New York house in Gramercy Park and writes this long legal treatise about possible precedents for what was going on, and doesn't really give approval to these efforts to install him as president through violence. But that's what's going on a few weeks before the inauguration, and nobody really knows who the president is going to be. There's thought that there might be two people pretending to be president, each having an army at its back.
And this is important to understand. Samuel Tilden, at least as far as we know, you'll correct me, won the popular vote.
He won the popular vote, but it looked like the... that Hayes had won the Electoral College, but these, as I say, these slates of electors were it wasn't clear who was the rightful winner in each of those states.
What's important to know about Rutherford B. Hayes, who would eventually win, be the Republican, and Samuel Tilden, the Democrat?
Hayes, as I say, fought for the Union during the Civil War. He's a lawyer from Ohio. This is not really important with regards to the 1876 election, but I was intrigued in my book to find him in 1860 saying that the South should be allowed to secede. It's kind of irrelevant for this topic, but he basically was in favor of letting the Southern states go and reconstituting the United States as a Northern country of only, you know, free states, which I think, you know, quite interesting. But, you know, Tilden, as I say, was massively wealthy. He was a railroad lawyer. I think he was connected to various, you know, corruption schemes of the 1870s. But I guess, you know, I think is remembered at least as not really so much of a fighter, because he wasn't willing to, you know, go the extra mile or to kind of bend the rules in order to, you know, see his way to victory. Though he was disappointed that Democrats ultimately agreed to submit to, you know, what we'll talk about next, the Electoral Commission, which was this kind of informal body set up by Congress in order to adjudicate the results, which he saw as a surrender before the fact, unnecessarily.
And that's interesting. I do want to ask you about this Electoral Commission. This wasn't an election that was actually, you know, that wasn't like 1800 and 1824 in which Congress, the House of Representatives, actually decided who would be the election. They formed, and this is what I sort of was trying to get at in my introduction when I said, once you get into this kind of territory, almost anything seems to be possible. And what they did in 1876 was to create this Electoral College. Tell me more about that.
Right. Electoral Commission. And it's different from those earlier elections in that it's not settled by Congress. And it's also different from 2000 in that it was not really settled by the Supreme Court. It's kind of a combination of those two scenarios where the commission is composed of five members of the House of Representatives, five senators, and five Supreme Court justices. So, you know, a totally extra constitutional mechanism. There's nothing in the Constitution or in any amendment that says that that's what you do if there's a stalemate between the two bodies of Congress. But the way that it worked out is that the partisan division on the commission was basically 8-7 in favor of the Republicans. And that's the way the vote ended up, that they gave Hayes the disputed electoral votes of those southern states by a vote of 8-7. So as in 2000, it was kind of a partisan vote where only one vote made the difference. But the bargain that the Democrats, and so then the question becomes, will the Democrats, you know, submit to this? Will they agree? And you still have many Democratic supporters writing to Tilden and writing to McClellan saying, you know, let's not accept this. Let's inaugurate Tilden in New York City and then march on Washington to throw Hayes out of office. But ultimately, in a literally cigar, you know, filled room in Washington, D.C. at a hotel, party bigwigs from both sides agree to a deal in which Democrats will submit to Rutherford Hayes's inauguration as president in only a few days. And in exchange, Hayes will remove federal troops from the south, not entirely from the south, really from two state capitals, I believe Baton Rouge and Columbia, South Carolina, where they were bolstering these Republican governments in the states. But effectively, it's to remove federal troops from the southern states and ultimately to end Reconstruction.
I mean, that's how they're enacting Reconstruction. It was through the military.
Exactly. After starting in 1867, when Republicans in Congress passed a law to establish military reconstruction, military occupation in the South, which is, you know, Southerners, of course, see as a continuation of civil war. And this, it's only this that ends it. And of course, unsurprisingly, immediately after those federal troops are removed from the state houses, Democrats retake control of those states and abandon the commitments to black equality and civil rights that they had, that those state governments had supposedly made after the Civil War.
So again, the Electoral Commission comes down 8-7 in favor of Rutherford B. Hayes, who would inevitably win, but they still have to negotiate some deal with the Democrats because they were afraid the Democrats, because they were basically trying to avert a civil war.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as Americans had many times in the country's history, the Democrats were basically blackmailing the Republicans and saying that we won't submit to the election unless you do this, you know, for us, unless you give us something. And as throughout American history, that tended to succeed. And it did in this instance, where they were able to make a plausible threat of violence, of refusing to recognize the legitimacy of Hayes's election, unless they received basically what they had fought the election to get in the first place, which was the end of Reconstruction. You know, within a decade or so, Democrats are back in power in the presidency, at least, and you know, have returned as a viable political party. So they kind of sacrificed this short term gain for a long term advantage.
And that this is being led by George McClellan on the Democrats. Right? They're even like threatening to set up a shadow government, I believe. I mean, this is.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate it. He's not really a leader of it, but he's very much involved in the conversations behind the scenes.
So he's not.
It didn't quite get to the point where he's actually, you know, drilling troops or something, but he's very much talking to his former, you know, allies from the Union Army about possibly doing something in the future. He's not actually organizing any kind of insurrection just yet. It didn't get to that point.
But even getting to the point I got to with George McClellan's interesting, because George McClellan was, in the early years of the Civil War, a top general under Lincoln, who, you know, is largely remembered for working sort of against Lincoln in the North in the war.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not terribly surprising. It is kind of a continuation of that and of his presidential campaign of 1864, where he, you know, that the slogan then, I'm not sure if they had the slogan that early, the Union as it was, the Constitution as it is, which is to say, basically, yes, the Union will stay together, but it won't, you know, the political reconstruction of the country will go no further. So it's quite consistent with his earlier career.
What more is important to understand about the compromise that was struck?
Yeah, I mean, this was the point of the Washington Post piece that I wrote, which is to say that I think a lot of people were looking at and are looking at possible historical precedents for a disputed election and the possibility of political violence afterwards. But I wanted to show that in 1876, the real terrible legacy of what happened is not the possibility that there was going to be violence, but what they did in order to avoid it, which is to say this, what's now called the Compromise of 1877, which repealed Reconstruction. And what that did is it essentially repealed the results of the Civil War. Yes, slavery continued to be abolished and wasn't coming back. But in every other way, the South basically got what it had fought the Civil War on behalf of. The country returned to the idea of states' rights, which is that each state could kind of establish and regulate its so-called domestic institutions, or really its systems of racial apartheid as it wished, and that's what Jim Crow was, and that compromise lasted for, you know, 70 years or so until the civil rights movement broke it apart. And that's what created the solid South and created this monolithic region where it was, you know, only, it was basically a one party state where only the Democratic Party was viable until the 1960s. So, you know, And my concern is, should the election be disputed again this winter, which, you know, I should mention is beginning to look a little bit less likely to me, given Trump's illness. And I think his electoral fortunes have considerably worsened. But should it happen, my concern is you know, what compromises will be proposed? What compromises will somebody like Joe Biden, you know, a kind of natural career long conciliator, reach in order to avoid worse violence? And the 1876 election, I think, is very much a cautionary tale in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear what you're saying about, you know, because of Trump's illness, that might change the calculation a little bit. I've thought about that, too. But we'll see. And
there's a lot of time, for sure.
A lot of time.
And I still think it's worth thinking about these questions now.
And again, one of the possibilities here in a potential comparison, and, you know, no two events in time are exactly alike. But it seems like a possible comparison is if they are able to whip up enough doubt about the vote in a particular state, what you might be right. able to do is get some electoral college votes nullified, and then mm-hmm. we're talking about the dynamic of being able to get to that 270 threshold for the electoral college votes that you need in order to get to win the presidency. If you come up short, even if you have a majority, but if you come up short of that 270 number, then that's when this whole machinery starts getting into action.
Right. And that's what, you know, that's kind of what happened in 1800, is kind of a different scenario, which, you know, I don't need to get into too much, but
feel free to.
OK. In basically what I was going to say is that the Democrats, of course, have a majority in the House of Representatives right now, but Republicans still control a majority of state delegations. And it's the state delegations that vote for president if that election is thrown into the House. Right now, you know, that means that they would probably be able to elect Trump again. The thing is that vote doesn't happen until January, after the new Congress is inaugurated. And I haven't yet seen any analysis of who would need to win or lose elections in order for the Democrats to take a majority of congressional delegations. That would be a very interesting piece to read. But in 1800, you know, this was before the 12th Amendment, which radically overhauled the Electoral College. And the way it worked was that whoever won the most votes became president, and whoever won the second number most votes became vice president. In 1796, 4 years earlier, this had led to the absurd situation of John Adams winning the presidency and his rival for the presidency, Thomas Jefferson, becoming his own vice president. So they were, you know, woefully mismatched and divided within the executive branch. And nobody wanted a repeat of that by 1800. So it was understood that Thomas Jefferson was the Republicans' presidential nominee, and Aaron Burr, who we all know from the musical, of course, was the Republicans' vice presidential nominee. But the Republicans won the election. They had far more votes than the Federalist candidate, John Adams. But the Republicans had forgotten to shave off a few votes from Burr in order to make sure that Jefferson won the presidential nomination, won the presidency. So Burr and Jefferson, who were supposed to be running mates, ended up with the same number of electoral votes. And neither of them were above, or it was a tie. So it was thrown into the House of Representatives, where Republicans had a plurality of congressional delegations, but not a majority. So they needed some Federalists to support Jefferson to become president, but they realized that gave them a lot of leverage. Now, this is a very different scenario because of the 12th Amendment. But basically, the Federalists tried to get Burr to agree to become president, and in that way, he would be more beholden to the Federalists than to his own Republican Party. And this was a stalemate. Burr was, you know, willing to listen to that possibility. And this was a stalemate that as in 1876, lasted well into February and looked very likely to end in a stalemate and no president and possibly a civil war. So another kind of interesting example where we're getting thrown into Congress can lead to all kinds of, you know, shenanigans, as you say, and possibly total gridlock.
And these historical periods, we're talking about 1800, 1876, they had a lot more time to figure it out before the inauguration occurred. As you mentioned, the inauguration happens in March. Now it happens, they have to have it all done by January 20th.
Yeah, which could be a problem this year, as you mentioned, I think, in whether states will have enough time to count all of these mail-in ballots. You know, that's what Trump was talking about at the debate last week. And it's actually, you know, pretty much a fairly valid concern, because it really does take a very long time for the ballots to be counted, for them to then be litigated by each side if they choose to challenge it. It really could go on, you know, well past the date set for the Electoral College gathering, which I believe is early to mid December. So if the election is at all close, then it could be a problem. I'm beginning to doubt that it's going to be close, which is why I hope we'll be able to avoid situations like this.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Richard Kreitner. Richard Kreitner is a contributing writer to The Nation, and he's the author of the book Break It Up: Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. Richard Kreitner, it's interesting, when we talk about 1800, when we talk about 1876, talk about 1828, talk about year 2000, I suppose, talk about now. But if we go back, say, even to 1800, and you talk about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, we have a way of remembering these people as largely being all on the same team, right? These were the quote-unquote founding fathers. But in reality, and this is really gets to the heart of your book, Break It Up, there has always been this great tension in this country over, and I guess we can relate it to union or disunion, but the politics of 1800 were really crazy. I mean, John Adams and his party basically made it illegal to run a Republican newspaper at the time.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you couldn't criticize the president or the Congress or the government of the United States. Conspicuously, you could criticize the vice president, who was his rival, Thomas Jefferson. There are bitter divisions in the group that we call the founding fathers, which is to me what gives the lie to this idea of originalism. What did the founders really think? How would they have applied the Constitution to our own problems, of which they knew absolutely nothing? They didn't even agree on how to apply the Constitution to their own problems, you know, of their own day. They're bitterly divided. I think that that's, as you say, that's basically what the story of the book is not only about American divisions, but American divisions gone to their most extreme point, which is the idea that the Union should not exist at all. And what's surprising is that a lot of these founders, not Adams, not Washington, but certainly Jefferson, had their doubts about that, about whether the Union should continue to exist. In response to the Alien and Sedition Laws that you mentioned, which basically outlawed criticism of the U.S. government, Jefferson considered supporting secession. You know, in his private letters with James Madison that became the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, which asserted a state's right to nullify federal law, he wanted to suggest that the states would secede from the Union if their grievances were not addressed. And there are other instances in Jefferson's political life where he supported the idea one way or another. An obvious indication that things were not really as settled or as definite or as destined as we now tend to think they were. You know, the Union was created as a means to an end, not as an end in itself, and it almost immediately fell apart. And there were always movements, you know, in one place or another, and basically at every time to break it up.
What's the driver behind this, do you think? I mean, obviously today we're a much bigger country than we were back in 1800, so that's going to bring its own implications into it. But, I mean, if we see this all the way basically from the beginning, what do you think the driver behind this question over union or disunion is?
There's a lot of ones. A lot of it's clashing interests, you know, especially back then. Each region had totally different economies and different economic interests. The New England states were largely commercial. They were interested in shipping and in trade, whereas the southern states were all about slavery, of course, you know, and were not really interested in building up a strong manufacturing center. So economic interest, distance, you know, sheer distance. Like one of the stories I tell, you know, you're in California, so you and your listeners will appreciate this, is the long history of California separatism. You know, it wasn't just Calexit after the 2016 campaign. In the 1840s and 1850s, there's a very strong movement for California to become its own separate nation. And also for Oregon, and possibly if the two territories join together. And that was because it was so far. The West Coast was so far from the East Coast. There was no transcontinental railroad. There was no Panama Canal. It took months to get from one end of the country to another. And it wasn't at all obvious to people on the ground on the West Coast at the time, or people back in the East, why these two totally separate parts of the continent should be one country. Again, pretty different these days, where you can fly from one end of the country to the other in 5 hours. But back then, it really made a great deal of difference. So we have interests, we have distance, and identities and ideas, I would say, also played a role. It wasn't the same people that settled each part of the country. You came from different areas in England, or you came from different areas in Europe. And that meant you had different, religious commitments or ideological commitments. And then that often led to, in the early 19th century, there was a very strong New England secessionist movement in 1803 to 1804. And then it kind of climaxed during the War of 1812. And, that was a very conservative movement, as against what they considered to be the Republicans, led by Thomas Jefferson's radicalism or sympathy with the French Revolution. So there you have kind of a they didn't call it that, of course, but kind of a left-right dynamic similar to today.
I mean, that's where we get our left-right dynamic, right? The French Revolution.
Yeah, exactly. It just didn't catch on in the U.S. as quickly.
Still early. are there moments, or has there ever been a more progressive secessionist movement?
Yeah, there have. My favorite story in the book, I guess, my heroes of the book are the abolitionists, disunion abolitionists, led by William Lloyd Garrison, who I think many people have heard of as the editor of The Liberator and kind of at the radical end of abolitionism. But he devised a theory that the Constitution itself bolstered slavery, which I think many of us increasingly accept these days, but it wasn't really very much talked about or accepted at the time, and that if the northern states seceded from the Union, the southern states would be deprived of those protections for slavery, and ultimately the institution itself would collapse. We didn't get a chance to test this theory, and a lot of historians have their doubts, but I think it's at least important that they had a story about how it would work, so that disunion, northern secession, was not simply a protest. It wasn't a way to kind of cleanse their own guilty consciences, but was actually a practical program for the end of slavery everywhere. And this was a very, a movement of growing popularity from the 1830s, when Garrison arrives on the scene, the 1840s, and especially in the 1850s. I tell the story of the 1850s in the book, not as the rise of a Southern separatist movement, but as the rise of a Northern discontent with the Union, and suggest that the Civil War actually could have started the other way with a Northern secessionist movement had the 1860 election gone differently. And it wasn't that this mass of Northerners came to be either abolitionists or disunion abolitionists, but they simply resented Southern control of the federal government, because the South did control the presidency and Congress, throughout most of the 1850s. And Northerners were very, upset with having to comply with the Fugitive Slave Law, which made every citizen responsible for assisting the capture of runaway slaves. And this led to growing talk of that the Northern states should secede from the Union to protest and undermine slavery. So I see that as a progressive disunion movement, and arguably one that has some lessons for today, at a time where, Republicans are the only ones really who play what some have called constitutional hardball, which is, bending the rules, in order to win power or hold on to it. Growing talk of court packing is another example of constitutional hardball. And I think suggests that the left today, or the Democratic Party, is starting to learn the lesson that Northerners did in the 1850s as well, which is that you have to stand up to bullying, and you have to be willing to not fight dirty, but fight hard for sure, or otherwise you're going to get rolled, and defeated every time.
It's so interesting to think about the parallels, and I've heard about these parallels of the 1850s. This is the decade before the Civil War, which I think you could argue may be one of the most contentious political moment before actual war was to occur, to compare the 1850s to this moment that we're now in.
Yeah, absolutely. After Ruth Bader Ginsburg, passed away, and Republicans violated their own rules, arbitrary ones, of a few years ago, and to say that they were going to appoint a new justice to the court, a lot of people were saying, you know, this is 1860. This is a massive escalation. But what I saw it as was 1854, you know, which is the moment that the Republican Party came into being to protest the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which was an act that ripped up the Missouri Compromise formed in 1820, which split the Louisiana Purchase into northern and southern components that would not and have slavery, and then the southern parts would. And that compromise lasted for 30, 34 years until the Kansas-Nebraska Act annulled it and said that those territories could be open to slavery if the you know, white male settlers on the ground decided to have a vote and to allow slavery. And northerners saw this as a horrible betrayal because they had submitted to this compromise and had held to it, and then the South was now violating it.
It was also about political power, right? Because if the South got the slave states, that meant more slave senators.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I don't mean to say it was simply that's basically what I meant to say about the Northerners did not become abolitionists. It wasn't a moral crusade for the vast majority of the Northern public. They simply resented the South's hold on political power in the Union. And the Whig Party, which was more prominent in the North than in the South, as opposed to the Democrats, who were more prominent in the South, was not willing to lead this fight against the slave power and against the repeal of the Missouri Compromise. And that's the moment that the Whigs died out as a party. So it seems to me that if the Democrats don't try to pack the court and pass other, you know, reforms, should they take power in January, you know, the Democrats might go the way of the Whigs and some other party that is willing to stand up to Republican aggression is going to, you know, rise up.
That's an interesting comparison to the Whig Party. I mean, it's oftentimes told the reason the Whig Party broke up was because it was divided on the issue of slavery itself.
That's exactly what I mean. It was so divided that they were not able to take any kind of aggressive counteraction, which is what the Northerners were starting to demand. I've seen a quote that the Whig Party died of compromises. That's a quote from that exact time. And I think that the Democrats are at some risk of doing the same.
Richard Kreitner, that was interesting. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
Richard Kreitner has been our guest again. Richard Kreitner is a contributing writer to The Nation magazine, and he's the author of the book Break It Up: Succession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union.